This podcast is sponsored by Safe House Rehab Thailand, the premier drug and alcohol rehab dedicated to enhancing the science of recovery. First, a plug for my sponsor, who has given me the opportunity to help the families and loved ones of alcoholics and addicts better understand the nature of the disease and what they can and shouldn't do about it, shouldn't try to do about it. We say in our podcast and blog that our primary goal is to help you make an informed decision at this critical stage of your life. Safe House Rehab Thailand represents the modern approach to recovery, founded on safety, which is why we absolutely outperform traditional rehabs when it comes to intake and detox, technology, and aftercare. To learn more about our modern, advanced approach to recovery, we invite you to visit safehouserehab.com or send your questions and comments to info@safehouserehab.com.
Take it back a bit. The first time I got drunk at the pub, alcohol stood out to me as the way to have fun.
Okay.
And that's where the progression started.
Okay.
And as I went along into further college and then to university, my way and my thinking of having fun and relating to people was through alcohol and drugs.
Okay.
When it got to university stage, halfway through uni, I couldn't go out and socialize unless I was already drunk.
Mm-hmm.
So I would always drink a lot, and then the drugs would come on.
Okay.
But I was always smoking weed during marijuana throughout the day.
So you started with alcohol usually, and then you went on to other things in the same evening?
Yeah, in the same evening.
Okay.
Or
that's not
or that's, at the same time.
Okay.
And the alcohol was every day,
right,
while I was at university.
Okay.
And that's where I started onto antidepressants as well.
Okay. What was your motivation for starting with antidepressants? Obviously you had to go to a doctor and get a prescription. So what was that conversation like?
I just said, to be honest, you just go in there, and I said, I feel depressed.
Okay.
And like, here you are, take
these. Were you depressed?
I guess I was to a degree because the drugs and the alcohol was contributing to it.
Uh-huh.
Because I didn't know how to function.
Okay.
Without that on a social aspect.
Okay. So not being able to function at the social aspect. Did you have trouble relating to other people, to women? What was the, when you say social aspect?
Yeah, relating to other people, women as well. Being able to talk to people on a sensible level.
Okay. When you drank and did drugs, it allowed you to be more social. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I believe I got some.
These are, okay.
But ultimately, I still was never satisfied.
Okay.
Because I would take it to another extreme.
Okay.
To the point of oblivion. So I wouldn't be actually socializing with people.
Got
I'd be
it.
In my own world.
You went around the bend.
Yeah.
Now, when you had that conversation with the doctor and he or she prescribed antidepressants, what effect did that have on you? What effect did the antidepressants have on you?
I took the antidepressants for probably about 3 months initially.
Okay.
And it didn't have any effect, really.
Okay.
Because
I carried my life. So it didn't do what you wanted it to do?
No, I just
What did you want it to do?
I wanted it to change the way that I was.
Okay. The way that you were. The way that you were feeling, or just the way you were acting, or?
I would say now the way that I was feeling.
Okay.
Though I didn't know about feelings.
Okay, got it. All right, I understand.
It's not a subject which...
So you didn't like the way you were?
Yeah, I just didn't like the whole package.
Okay,
So there was this discontent with who I was.
Okay, that's very important.
And
this is important
The alcohol
stuff.
And the drugs allowed me to be who I thought
who
I
you
should be.
You should be. Okay, very good, very good. So if you want to just give me the trajectory, you sobered up at about 34, right? You're 36. And you're at this point, you're in university or leaving university. So you went on into a career of some sort, or what happened after, quote, school?
Yeah. Just mentioned that when I was 20, I had a drug-induced psychosis.
Okay. That's important.
Yeah. And
what was that about?
It was actually on New Year's, and I still don't have the full recognition, though it has changed me on a mental level.
Okay, so who said it was a psychosis?
From what I've explained it to my counselors over here.
Okay. So you described a state of mind and emotion that was later diagnosed as a drug-induced psychosis.
Psychosis.
All right. What was? Tell me what happened. What was it like?
My outlook on the world. I became more introvert. Whenever I would smoke marijuana, I would go into severe paranoia.
Okay.
I thought everyone was out to get me.
How long did it last?
And till date, probably. I carried on smoking till I was 26.
Okay.
Then one day I just gave up smoking marijuana till I was 26. And on occasion, until I was 34, I would have a little bit here and there.
So you were in a psychotic state for quite a while.
Yeah, yeah. And the drugs would also take me there. For some reason, alcohol would... I was different on alcohol.
In what way?
Karma.
Okay.
Well, no, it was weird because it would calm me internally, but outwardly it would make me an aggressive person.
Okay, got it.
And I enjoyed that.
Okay.
It would just block out whatever was going on.
You like the acting out part?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, bit of an actor out. It would block out the rest of the world.
Okay.
And allow me to be who I was internally. Just thought I was satisfied with it. That was the way to go.
Okay.
And seeing society where alcohol was so free, I believed it was okay to do. It was
between 20 and 26. What were you doing?
I was at university. I did a year in Hartlepool. It was it's a factory town.
Okay.
It was a little bit racy, so I wouldn't.
But
go
I mean,
out.
Were you working? Were you?
Yeah,
making
I was working on a factory, steel factory.
Okay.
As the environmental assistant.
Okay.
And was getting paid, though I would spend all my free time outside of work in my flat,
okay,
drinking, and just the weekends I would be doing drugs. Ketamine, I moved to ketamine,
okay,
a lot of ketamine, because I would be on my own.
Going back to the steel factory, was it a responsible position? What sort of position did you have?
It was a fairly responsible position in terms of I was helping the environmental manager,
okay,
to ensure that the factory was meeting its environmental.
Okay, that sounds responsible. How was your performance?
Overall, I was quite dedicated to the job. I enjoyed it. I'd implemented a few things for the factory, an oil skimming system.
Okay. Were you given performance reviews?
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
Okay. And, did pretty well.
Did well, and there was the possibility. I had to go back to university to finish my final year, and there was I was offered the possibility of to be employed,
okay,
taken on for a full time job.
So you have a responsible position. You're doing fairly well, but you're also abusing drugs and alcohol in the meantime. And did you feel that was something that was sustainable for you over the long haul, or you didn't think about it?
I didn't think it was sustainable. I just knew I would have to stop. I just thought it would happen.
Okay.
There was no real thought into it.
So you had the feeling that this can't go on, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you didn't know exactly.
Once the obsession got hold of me, which was nearly all the time.
Right.
And then the compulsion came in, everything else went out the window.
Okay. When did you leave the job? What happened to leave the job?
I had to go back to university to finish my final year.
You did that?
It was part of the program.
You did that?
I was doing an industrial degree.
Okay.
And I went back to university, and that's where the other three years came on top.
Okay. All right.
Because I was lying to the university. The drugs and the alcohol got in the way of my performance and my education system.
Okay.
Because from waking up in the morning, the first thing, I lived just to drink.
Okay.
And do drugs.
Right.
And at that point, it was mainly drinking in my life. The drugs would be on at night time.
Did you leave the job? Did they fire you? What happened?
No. It was just a one year contract.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what?
As an internship.
Okay. And then what?
And then went back to uni. Didn't really do that well. I finished my degree. It took me 3 years to finish the degree.
Right.
I stayed at university in Leeds for another 2 years.
Okay.
And then for the final year, I went back home. I moved into my parents' house.
Where?
Back in London.
Okay.
And finished it off as a part-time student, or deferred, call it deferred student.
Okay.
Station. I didn't get an honours degree, it was a BSc. Bachelor of Science,
a basic degree,
mm-hmm. Minimal grade, just passed.
But you got your degree.
I got my degree.
All right.
And from there, it was the same thing. I had no direction in my life. I thought I had already failed. For me, that was all failure.
But you moved back with your parents, and you said you had an enabling mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So talk about that.
So with my mother, I could always spin things around. I could turn them on her.
Okay.
I was able to emotionally blackmail her,
okay.
guilt trip her. I could take money from her. I would steal money from her.
Okay.
My father wasn't living with us.
Were they divorced at this point, or just separated, or just...
No,
he wasn't there.
Yeah, he was still working in Dubai.
He
would come on occasion.
So you moved back with your mom in London, and your dad was in Dubai.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And I had a lot of resentment against my father, because I had also earlier on when I was 15... caught him in bed with another woman.
Okay. So your dad really disappointed you.
Yeah, he definitely did his best and loves us in the way that he knows how.
Okay.
And I can't fault him at all for providing me every opportunity in life.
Sure.
It was just, I wasn't responsible for myself.
Okay.
I transferred the responsibility of my life onto others.
So you're in London with your mom, mm-hmm. and you're manipulating her, and I mean, this is, no judgments, but here you are, full-blown addict alcoholic at home with your mother.
Yeah.
So now what do you do?
I was applying for jobs.
Okay.
I would go out.
You're trying to get work.
Yeah, I was trying to get work within my field or any field. And I wouldn't turn up to the interviews. I'd either be too hungover.
Okay. All right. So you were dysfunctional already at that point.
There was also fear, that fear of failure. So I was like, I would convince myself that there's no point going because I'm not going to get the job.
Okay.
Then somehow I ended up falling into gardening. And I started my own little gardening business.
Okay.
And painting and decorating.
Okay.
And again, I really enjoyed doing that. However, that for me was seen as a means just to earn money to buy alcohol and cocaine.
Okay.
And I would sit, I would work one day and two days, cash in hand. Then I would spend that money on alcohol and gambling, online gambling and cocaine, and sit up for most of the day and the night just doing that in my room on my own.
When you say you were gambling, how were you gambling?
Online poker.
Okay.
Let's say I didn't make any money.
okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, you had the freedom. You had your own little gig, and you could do what you wanted.
Mm.
Right? And that was the motivation.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do a little fast forward to what happened to wake you up.
Yeah. There were points where when I was 27, went to Honduras to live with my brother for a bit.
Okay.
And again, the drinking there was a lot of conflict with him because of my behavior, the way that I acted.
Right.
And I thought I blamed him for everything. But ultimately, it was my behaviors around my obsession and compulsion for drinking.
Okay.
Wasn't doing any drugs there. And then moved back to my mom's house. The relationship was very strained with my mom and my family. And in their own words, they had to walk on eggshells around
sure.
me.
Yep, common.
Yeah, I was quite explosive, would damage property in the house if I didn't get what I wanted. 28, I moved to Dubai. I knew I had a sort of problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought moving to Dubai to live with my father, and there was a small job that I could do in uncle's company, uncle being a friend,
all right.
as a sales assistant. And I moved up to being a sales manager.
Okay.
It was quite dysfunctional for me. In Dubai, I probably stayed sober for the first 2 months.
Okay.
And then got into drinking.
Great. So when would you say, under what circumstances would you say you bottomed out? What? Just tell us about the what happened part.
6 months before I came into recovery, I had a hip replacement.
Okay.
My right hip. And I'd been suffering with that for about 3 years.
All right.
I gave up on life. after the hip replacement, I'd stayed sober for 2 months before. And during, but after the hip replacement, the recovery period, by this time I had also been, I was addicted to codeine medication, benzos, and then I was drinking a lot. So during my recovery period, while I was stuck at home, I was always obsessing about alcohol.
Sure.
All my behaviors.
So you had painkillers in you.
Yeah. And this this was I for a number of years while I was in Dubai.
I understand.
And you know, this time I'd always want to drink every day, just aggression. When I was not drinking, I wasn't able to control who I was. I didn't know who I was.
Okay.
I felt there was always an acting out.
Okay.
I'd moved back, so I did my recovery in England for my hip, and then I moved back to Dubai into a job, and I was still sort of recovering from the hip replacement, but I thought I had turned a new leaf. I was like, you know, I'll turn a new leaf of life. I won't drink as much.
Okay.
I will just do it on the weekends.
Right. Try to control it.
It didn't work out.
Okay.
All right. And I ended up drinking every day, every single day.
Okay.
And then one day I was just in a bar, and...
So give me the one day part, because the audience wants to know what happened, when did the light go on? Because the audience is always interested in less about the details, but more about that moment of awakening.
Mm. It's a build-up over a week.
Okay.
Week period.
Right. So you're in a bar at this point and something happens?
Yeah, in Dubai, okay, so I'd gone to jail and prison as well.
Okay.
For drinking, drink driving, and there you can go to prison, and I'd gone. But also jail for fighting a few times. Jail being the one in the police station, prison being the actual prison. But this was over the years while I was living there. But I was in this bar having a chat. I was very dazy because I wouldn't eat. I would just drink. I would be doing codeine and benzos. And I can't really remember what happened, but I picked up the pint glass and smashed it over this person's face.
Okay.
And I had physically harmed them. Obviously got into a fight, gone to jail. It shook me that I had harmed someone else, even though it was normal to it. But I had no feelings around. I didn't care. He didn't press charges because these are the okay. It was behaviors. He didn't press charges because I threatened him. I would know people, and this is just the way it works in Dubai. And then a few days later, I attacked my father.
Okay.
And there was just this complete destroying. I had this self-loathing and self-hate, and it came to the point of. And prior to all of this, for a few years, I'd started cutting myself to feel something.
Okay.
I would get excessively drunk, and then start cutting myself. I started with scissors, and then moved on to knives.
Okay.
And blades.
So you're becoming self-destructive. Mm-hmm. Anger. You're becoming destructive to others. And then the light goes on. Again, tell me what happened with that moment.
It's a tough moment, but it's one that I do have to remember to know that the life I have now is way better than before.
Okay.
And that moment was, I just got drunk one night, came home, and I started slashing myself over my legs. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to end it, staring at myself in the mirror.
Okay.
And I'm sitting on the floor in my bedroom with a bottle of JD next to me and a blade in my throat, sort of telling myself even that I can't even kill myself.
Okay.
And my mother walks in. And at that point, I surrendered and said, I need help.
Okay. This is very important stuff.
Mm-hmm. So I had a psychiatrist.
So you say you surrendered, and at that moment you said, I need help. Then what did you do?
And a few years prior to that, my psychiatrist, who I was just using as a way to get benzos, had said to me that you need to go to rehab.
Okay.
He had suggested a rehab in Thailand. Okay. And he had said go to an AA meeting. I went to one AA meeting. I thought it was a cult. Left it and went straight to the bar.
Okay, tell me again. You surrendered and you said you need help.
Yeah.
Tell me from that moment.
And then the next day I caught... So that was obviously a shocking moment for my mum. It was for me... I was destroyed inside, desolate. There was no future.
Okay, what action did you take?
The next day, called my psychiatrist, and I said, what was the name of that rehab that you... So he gave me the name, I called the rehab up, and booked in the first place that they had available. I explained a little bit of my story to them.
Okay.
Before, not story, I would say. I just explained where
right,
I was.
Okay.
I didn't say anything about...
This was a rehab in Thailand.
Yeah. I didn't know about addiction. I didn't know about alcoholism. Right. I just knew I needed some form of help and get me out of wherever I'm at.
So you made arrangements. You got on a plane. How long before... How much time was there between the time you made the call and the time that you arrived in Thailand? A week?
It was roughly a week, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Roughly a week.
All right. So you had already made that decision. Did you use or drink between the time that you made the call and the time you arrived in Thailand?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. No, yeah. I mean, this is common.
There was no... I was...
So you realize you need help. More. You realize you need surrender, but you're still using and drinking. That's very common.
Yeah.
There's nothing unusual about that. So you get on a plane and you get here, and then what happens?
And during that time, I was... Not even, I was thinking of cancelling it.
Okay, got
the whole
it.
Time. I would convince myself that there's no issue, or I'm fine.
Okay, got it. But what happened when you got here?
When I got to Thailand, yeah, the primary rehab picked me up from the airport.
Okay.
I was fairly drunk.
Okay.
The guy who met me at the airport was very nice and friendly. I didn't know what I was in for, but I knew I had to do it.
Did your dad pay for this?
Yes, we paid for more by my parents.
Okay. So you came here, and then what happened?
Yeah.
So you came in, you went into intensive therapy, inpatient.
Inpatient primary rehab, where I had to obviously detox first.
Right.
And in the detox process, it was fairly tough for the first 11 days.
Okay.
Didn't really sleep.
Okay.
1 hour a night.
Okay.
It was...
Sure, you were off everything at this point.
So for the first 2 months at primary rehab, I was still on benzos.
Okay.
When they gave, because my intake of benzos was quite high, when they had initially given me to help with my alcoholism, for me to be detox of alcohol.
Right.
They give you some...
They knew what you were taking, though, coming in, though. I mean, they knew everything, your drug history.
They had to increase the dose because for sleeping family.
Oh, had to. Okay. So it's a tranquilizer, right?
Yeah.
Is that what it is? Okay.
In essence, yeah, it's a tranquilizer.
Okay.
Yeah. And
so it helps
that,
you come down from alcohol?
To help ensure the person doesn't have a seizure.
Yeah, sure. Alcohol, as it turns out, is the most dangerous drug to withdraw from.
It is,
So they'll give you some medication, and it varies. So so go ahead.
And I was in the treatment process. I booked in for a month, thought I would do a maximum of two.
Right.
After 3 weeks, I didn't have to, but I was going back for my hip replacement checkup.
Oh, okay.
I was advised not to by my counselor, by the rehabs, by the rehab and other people, friends at the rehab. Though I was very stubborn, and ultimately that was because I wanted to go back out to drink.
Oh, sure.
I understood that.
So what did you end up doing?
I went back to the UK, I flew to the UK.
Okay.
I would say I would come back to the rehab after 5 days.
Okay.
Flew to the UK, and it was the time of my birthday.
Okay.
So this all sort of was planned.
All right, so got it. There's a plot afoot here.
Yeah,
okay.
But I didn't see the plot that I was plotting.
All right, okay, got it, sure. Yeah. Subconscious.
And got to the... didn't drink while I was in the UK. And then I got to the airport in the lounge. On the way back.
And you're in, where are you now? At Heathrow, or are you in...
I was in Gatwick.
Gatwick Airport. Okay, but you were in the UK at this point.
Yeah, I was in the UK.
You're waiting to...
Go back to
Thailand. To go back to Thailand.
To the rehab.
Right.
And I used a text where I was a bit annoyed at the text from a friend.
Uh-huh.
And I said...
Decided to have a drink?
To have a drink.
Okay.
And
how many did you have?
Vividly. As soon as the alcohol touched my lips, there was no going back. I couldn't stop.
How many drinks did you have?
I don't know, but I spent £3,000 in 2 days.
So you never made the plane? Did you make
the
plane?
I made that plane. I was in the lounge.
So how does one spend £3,000 in 2 days in the lounge at the airport?
You don't buy anything. It's free, but I got to Dubai.
So you flew through Dubai?
I flew through Dubai.
I got it.
I got to Dubai. It was all you can drink. So on the plane, I upgraded myself to business so I could drink more.
Uh-huh.
That is just the
insanity. Okay, sure, sure. That happens.
And
so you go London to Dubai and then to Bangkok, right?
And then to Bangkok. In Dubai, I missed my flight to Bangkok.
Okay. All right, just spend the night there then?
Yes, I spent the night there drinking. I went straight from the airport to the bar that I know is a local place.
Okay. Did you see your dad on the way back? Did you see your dad on the way?
Yeah, for a couple of hours.
Yeah, I was completely... So you spent one night in Dubai?
Yeah, one night.
Well, so you spent a ton of money, you got drunk, and then you went on to Bangkok.
Yeah, and I spent it on women and, other things. In certain services.
Okay, sure.
And then when I got to the airport, I missed my flight. The next flight was in 12 hours, roughly. Okay. So
Layover, more booze.
Yeah, and I thought, great, you know what? How can I get into the lounge? You're like, oh, you can't check in at the moment to go into the lounge.
Right.
You have to wait at least 4 or 5 hours before.
Okay.
So I said, if I book myself into first class, because in my head it was like, you get your own cubicle. Yeah.
Okay, got it. Yeah. So you did that and you flew to Bangkok.
Yeah, and I flew to Bangkok.
And they picked you up and you were drunk.
And they picked me up and I was drunk, yeah. Yeah. Okay. The next day that
I know that was going to be? Because I did the same thing. Yeah. We all do this. You're not unique, my man.
Yeah.
I've traveled all over the world drunk on an airplane, okay? Yeah. Nothing new. And missed flights. All right.
Many times.
So they picked you up and they took you back to the rehab.
Rehab. And, you know, thank whatever higher power that I actually got to Bangkok, because now I realize I could have never got to Bangkok.
Right, of course. And, you could have stayed in Dubai or gone to Africa.
Yeah, or anywhere.
Or anywhere, really.
Or ended up dead.
Is serious, of course.
And the serious part is...
So now there's a moment as you're telling this that you say, thanks to my higher power... You feel like somehow there was some destiny involved in you doing the right thing, right?
Yeah, and there was. And I've come to believe that.
Uh-huh.
When I look back on many, I shouldn't be alive where I am today.
Right.
For all the accidents I've had, the harm I've caused others, the harm I've caused myself throughout my whole
addiction history. Tell me about your next phase in the rehab.
Yeah, woke up the next day and there was this intense guilt and shame, and I realized that is where now I need to take this seriously.
Okay, and you're now, you've awakened at the rehab, right?
You're knowing that I have an addiction and alcoholism problem.
So the light really went on at that point, not earlier really, but this was your true bottoming out, right?
This was my bottoming out to surrendering that I had an alcohol and drug problem.
So this was our first step thing. Admitted we were powerless, all that stuff.
Okay. Yeah,
and so how much longer did you stay at the rehab?
I stayed at the rehab for another 2 months.
Okay.
In total, 3 months at the primary rehab.
Okay. And then sober living?
Then I moved on to sober living.
Okay.
And that I needed that.
How long again, is sober living?
Do I explain that being discharged from rehab?
Sure.
I was at the rehab for 3 months. The primary, I was going to do a fourth. And again, a higher power moment that I see it. I was contemplating at this point to go to the second stage sober living rehab.
Right.
Move on. But I don't think I would have gone for it if this didn't occur in my life, where on the last day of my third month, where I was supposed to do another fourth month at the primary rehab, I got into a fight and I attacked someone.
Okay.
And in doing so, I got discharged. This is where the higher power worked for me.
Quote, kicked out?
Yeah.
All right. You got kicked out because you were fighting.
Yeah, because I went to attack someone. Luckily, no one was harmed.
All right.
And people intervened.
Right.
So I understood my behavior because at this point, my mind was clearer.
Right.
And
but you still had anger. Obviously, you were still angry.
Yeah, there was a lot of anger issues. And there still is, but I get to work on it. I'm a lot calmer.
Okay.
And we're sitting here today.
So you get discharged, as you say. Then what did you do?
They actually called the sober living place to see if there was a room available for me.
And?
That day. And there was.
Okay.
So I transferred over to the sober living.
Okay.
Having gone to the sober living again, there was another sort of rock bottom. I wasn't sure if I wanted to stay or go. And that the high power moment was...
But you weren't drinking or using anymore.
No.
Okay. All right. So now all of that anesthesia having to do with your feelings and your emotions, all that's gone. Now you got to deal with your real feelings, right? Without any anesthesia. Well, by that I mean drugs, alcohol, whatever.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that's a scary time too, because you don't have, or you choose not to have anything to... anesthetize you at that point or take you away from it. So how long were you in sober living?
In total, I was at the sober living for 7.5 months.
Okay, excellent.
It was a 12-step based sober living program.
Okay.
In there, I was properly, I would say. In the rehab, we were introduced to the AA fellowship and the NA fellowship.
Right.
Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous. Sure. The sober living was a 12-step program where, initially, for the first 2 months, I didn't do any 12-step work.
Okay.
It was based or derived from the Alcoholics Anonymous fellowship.
Sure.
And I resisted that because I wanted to do it my way. Okay. I just knew that if I left, I would
die. Were you resisting the idea of a higher power?
At that point, no. I was just resisting
the program.
Actually, program and the concept of a higher.
Yeah, all
it
of
didn't
that.
Really bother me so much. The higher power is more seeing
the
devotion because of my growing up within, and I use the word devotion here, but not in a negative when it comes to the fellowship.
Right. Dedication.
I knew that I had to be sober and clean for the rest of my life, but I didn't want to do it that way.
That way.
And
okay.
I tried many things for 2 months.
Okay.
And
all right.
Didn't work.
Okay.
And because
when you say it didn't work, you didn't go back out there and drink.
I didn't go out and drink, but it didn't work for me in terms of.
Didn't give me any peace of mind.
Peace of mind or settlement within my emotions and spiritually.
Got it. Okay.
There was still a lot of discontent.
Tell me about your typical day at sober living. Mm. What was sort of routine did you have?
In sober living, we'd wake up. I would wake up around 6 o'clock.
Okay.
Sometimes do a bike ride for 45 minutes to an hour.
You're near the beach there too, aren't you? Yeah, that's pretty good.
Along the beach. And then at 8 o'clock was the program began where we would have to do a walk or a quick
run
along the
beach. Did you
eat
prior to that? Did you have breakfast prior to that?
No, post that. And then we'd get back and between 8:30 to 9:15 would be the time to just shower up and have breakfast.
Okay.
And at 9:15 we'd just have a quick morning check-in.
Okay.
Do some readings,
okay.
A meditation,
okay.
And then the day would begin for the program.
Okay.
Either you would have free time, which was suggested to work on the 12-step program.
Okay.
As you know, for the first 2 months, I didn't.
Okay, that's all right.
And then you would have a group session.
Okay.
We'd have group sessions.
Were they moderated by a counselor or
moderated by the counselor?
Okay.
Yeah. So the group sessions were 3 times a week, Monday. Okay. Wednesday and Friday.
Okay.
And then we would have 2 sessions of step work.
Okay.
We call it where you'd be working through the 12-step program.
With a day with a or a week coach. During the week?
This during is, the week.
Okay.
And you work with a step coach.
So
you,
okay.
You, so there was a lot of free time as well in between. We'd also have activities where twice a week we could either go for yoga or Muay Thai.
Okay.
It would take us.
Got it.
To the gym, and we'd visit the orphanage once a week.
Okay.
For an hour, and I really enjoyed that. In the beginning, I didn't. But
so you were. It sounded like a fairly structured, but not free flowing. But you had a lot of your own. You had to put a lot of yourself into it.
Yeah.
You could either go through the motions, or you could actually participate. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Everything was our responsibility.
Okay. Very important to know.
There was a.
You had to own your own recovery. In other words,
there was a plan, in which if we didn't want to follow, we didn't have to.
Right.
They made us to the best, but whereas in primary, everything was structured.
Got it. Yeah. All right. So this is semi-structured.
Yeah, semi-structured.
Okay.
To take.
What'd you do on the weekends? Was there a structure on the weekends?
On the weekends, we would drive over to the primary where a rehab where nearby there would be an AA meeting.
Okay.
We would attend that. They would take us to the big supermarket for shopping.
Oh yeah, I ran into some of you guys there one day.
Yeah, that's where we met.
Yeah, the first time. There you go. So let me get this straight. Did you end up going to from your location there to the Friday meeting at the Jump 10 Long Stay, or did you end up going to the AA meetings right there from your sober living?
Yeah. So the sober living had it had stage one and it had stage two.
Okay.
You're an outpatient.
Okay.
So for my last 2.5 months at the sober living facility, I was an outpatient where I got my own apartment.
Oh, got it. Okay.
I would still attend
very good.
The full program.
Okay, very good.
But it
was
all my choice. The only requirement would be to attend the meetings that they had on site.
Okay, so they had on site meetings. Right, okay.
However, all of it was optional.
Okay.
When you're in the facility itself, everything was required to be done.
Okay.
But there was a lot of free time for you to work on yourself.
Okay. All right.
And the emphasis is that you ask for help.
Got
rather
it.
Than be given the help. In primary, you were given and forced to work.
Well, that makes sense. That's a progression where you start to own it.
Yeah.
So what are you doing these days to stay clean and sober?
So these days I attend a meeting regularly. It was quite difficult during the beginning of COVID because I'd left the rehab in the sober living structure in January.
Okay.
And then lockdown occurred in March.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
Between January to March.
You have your own apartment, though.
Yeah, I
have
my own apartment.
Yeah, okay.
I was committed to doing 90 and 90.
90 meetings in 90 days for the audience, just so they know.
Yeah, 90 meetings in 90 days.
Okay, and did you do that?
I did that.
Well, did that include Zoom, or was that faced?
Zoom came in because of the lockdown.
Yeah.
But prior to doing that, while I was an outpatient at the Sober Living, I had begun attending the meetings in Pattaya.
Okay.
The Jom Tien Noon.
Okay, sure, sure.
AA meeting, and from the other fellowship as well.
Okay.
One meeting a week. And that was to ensure that I was building up a structure and connection system around me. And at this point,
Did you have a sponsor?
At that point, yes, I had a sponsor.
Okay. And did you work with your sponsor? And did you still have a sponsor?
Yeah, I still have the same sponsor. We worked together at that point. At that point, while I was a part of the Sober Living Facility and program, we weren't working. We were more just getting to know each other.
Got it. Okay.
The trust was a big part of me.
Sure.
And it took
building months. Trust. And then he took you through the 12 steps and all of that.
Yeah. Currently, I'm on step 4.
Okay.
So
and you can explain the audience what step 4 is.
So I'll come to that. And, I had done steps 1 to 3, which, do you want me to say them?
Powerlessness, belief in the higher power, and then turning your will over to the care of a higher power. Those essentially making the turn from self-sufficiency to depending on a higher power.
And then the
fourth step is, if you could explain that.
The fourth step is taking a moral inventory of myself to see how I have affected my life and those around me.
Okay, excellent. Okay.
In essence, what was my part and my responsibility in my own life?
Right.
Did I take the responsibility for it?
All right.
Which comes into step 5.
Right, exactly. Okay.
It is quite an intense step.
Searching and fearless moral inventory is what it is. And so let's talk about this business of a moral inventory. That suggests that one has developed or rediscovered their conscience at that point, correct? Better be correct.
I have. So during this process, I would practice meditation, prayer, spiritual principles to the best of my ability.
Okay.
Attending meetings regularly, listening, calling, we call them old timers.
Sure. Yeah.
People with more experience in the program and a lot of time.
Being an old timer is an honor, you know.
Yeah, thank you.
We hope one day you'll be one.
I do hope so. Doing little things to enjoy my life because the only enjoyment, it was very difficult for me and I still find it to be able to enjoy life. Simple fact being, where you put Mentos in a Coca-Cola bottle. It's very simple.
Right.
I share this because it gave me such joy to do. I never did that as a child.
As innocent stuff without alcohol or drugs to enjoy yourself.
And I just thought, one day I was talking with a friend, they showed me a YouTube video about it. So I thought, you know what? I wasn't ashamed to say I've never done it. And I had the courage and confidence and I was like, should we go do it?
Fun,
and I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I've never learned to ride a motorbike.
Okay.
So I'm currently doing that.
All right. Well, we miss a lot of our growing up years when we're caught up in that stuff, don't we?
Yeah.
Right.
And there are down days and there are up days.
Okay.
However, I have through the program and the AA program is what I talk about here.
When is your sobriety birthday? Share that. What's your sobriety birthday?
February 5th, 2019.
Okay. All right. Okay. So that you're coming up on 2 years.
Coming up on 2 years.
Good for you.
And a lot of it has to do, because of the we have in the AA program, is that we go through this as a team.
Okay.
There are ups and downs.
So right.
My network is so important to me. I have people in my life today who I can trust.
Right.
And I hope that they can trust me.
Talk about your development to enable yourself to trust others. Because you talked about your anger. You talked about your abandonment with respect to your father, mostly. And yet you've turned the corner and you've learned how to trust people. That's huge. That's a big spiritual leap, isn't it?
Yeah. Step two for me, which is we came to believe in a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, was a huge turning point.
Okay.
That is where I was open to the idea of a higher power.
Okay.
Religion, and this is not a religion, it's a spiritual way. Religion aspects don't suit me.
Okay.
So I was open to it, and I began working on the step with an open mind, and when I did so, something changed.
Okay.
And I realized that there is a power greater than myself, and I could see the insanity of the way that I lived through obsession and compulsion before, and how it affected certain behaviors of
myself. That's great insight. And is the we a big part of the higher power?
It is.
Okay.
It is. And my higher power is of my understanding. So it's not imposed upon me by anyone. We're
freer
in AA.
Right.
We're accepting. It's a chance. It's like medicine. I go there to get my daily dose of medicine to ensure that I don't pick up another drink.
There you go. And how many meetings a week do you, either Zoom or person to person? Every day, or pretty much every day?
I do a meeting every day, whether it be in person or on Zoom.
Okay.
In the beginning, I did the 90 and 90.
90 meetings, 90 days.
Yeah, 90 meetings in 90 days, and I didn't even know when I finished. I just carried on doing it.
Yeah, just kept going.
I enjoy
it. So you enjoy it now. It's not like you have to. It's like you want to, right?
Yeah, initially it was determination that got me there. The understanding of my step one, that I'm powerless over this and this can destroy my life.
Okay. And so some people talk about desperation as a gift. Do you share that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Desperate. Now, I wanted to kill myself, as I shared earlier. I didn't want to live. Now I have a passion to live.
Okay.
I don't know how yet I'm going to live.
Oh, you're living now, man. You're giving back just talking to us.
Yeah, and AA's given me a whole breadth of tools to live by, but also things that I can do in my life.
Okay.
And that's the beauty for me.
You're starting to explore, we know each other. You're starting to explore career options and stuff like that. And you probably, tell me if I'm wrong, you probably never thought that you would be at that point where now you're free of this, you know, obsession, and you're looking at different career opportunities.
Yeah, I'm free of the shackles, and I begin to understand who I am and what benefit I can be of service to the world.
Okay.
And service to myself.
Right.
And my higher power. My higher power helps me massively on a daily basis, and sometimes on a minute-by-minute basis, because it allows me to know that I need never use again or pick up a drink.
Right.
And just by saying that, and that was said to me every month by someone in the fellowship. Initially, I didn't like it, but I was like, what are you talking about? It makes sense. Then one day, a light bulb went off, and I realized that I can live that way.
Okay. So the light keeps going on, right? You get this light and this light. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Like I'll share it sometimes that the worst day, any worst day that I have now is nowhere near as bad as it was before.
Right. I've heard it said that once in a while when I was drinking I had a good day, now once in a while I have a bad day.
Yeah, it's getting there, yeah.
Yeah.
I can see that. It is initially tough in the first year.
Right.
But it's worth it, and it was worth it in the first year. when I truly look back, there are no regrets about me making this decision to go to the rehab or to come to recovery and put down that bottle.
What lesson would you give to other people in your generation who might be struggling with alcohol and drugs? And parallel to that, what would you advise, let's say, parents to do under these circumstances? Let's say they have a son who's 30 and he's home and he's, you know, struggling, he's doesn't have a job. What sort of advice would you give a parent under those circumstances?
I have something. Sorry, bear with me. It was there. I was thinking about something
else. All right.
Is seek help. Okay. Ask for help. We're not alone.
What signs should they look for, though? I mean, a lot of parents don't even know. I mean, you know how it is. I know how it is. Mm-hmm. I hid my addiction.
Very well.
I lied about it. I manipulated. I denied it. Mm. I minimized it. I avoided it. You know, I attacked my mom. Not attacked her, but I attacked her, and then she got defensive, and I made my getaway because I deflected the blame. Right. Mm. So all these dynamics are happening in the family. What would you say to a mother who has a son who's 30 years old? What signs should she be looking for? Defiance?
Yeah.
Denial?
If you find that you're being manipulated, and manipulation I mean by control,
uh-huh.
If there is certain patterns, to look for patterns,
okay,
which just don't seem to fit in to the way that you would know.
Okay, so abnormal type of patterns.
Yeah. There's a saying, if you want to really know who you are, go and ask your mother.
Okay.
Or your closest family, the one who brought you up.
All right.
So
and if you're
there was
not
a personality
that, that means that something's wrong.
Yeah, if there's a personality changes.
Change, okay.
If there are evident personality changes, if you find there could be aggression.
Okay, how about isolation?
So we're looking at certain points like aggression, isolation, but also there being the opposite to too much joyfulness. Some people also...
Manic type behavior.
Yeah, where there could be manic type behavior. I was angry all the time.
Okay.
There is a friend of mine who is always happy.
Okay.
But that's in a negative sense because that's their defense mechanism.
Okay.
To hide. Okay. The discontent within.
Okay. Got
within.
It. Got
so
it.
So they are.
But was that a change from the way he was before? Just tell me. So here's a guy who's always happy, but he's hiding something.
Mm.
Has he always been a happy person, or did he start to on?
He was always putting it on before as his defense mechanism.
Okay.
And during the getting to know him very well during the recovery process, the onions of the layers of that was coming undone.
Okay.
It was quite strange because we were talking.
That wasn't
opposites.
What he was really feeling, is what you're saying.
Yeah, he was masking his feelings, but we were told opposites. I was a very aggressive person, whether it be outwardly or passively.
Okay.
He was this happy, joyous, overly enthusiastic individual.
Right.
But ultimately, as we got to know each other, we realized, initially we didn't like each other, but as we got to know each other, our emotions and our feelings were the same, and we were just using different mechanisms to mask it. Because there was this underlining issues within myself.
So what's next for you now? What are you going to do next now? Yeah. You're clean and sober, you're successful in your recovery, you're very active, you're very busy, you're doing all the things that are absolutely right in your second year of recovery. So what's next for you now? Just beyond your recovery program, what are you looking forward to?
So, as cliche as the saying is, the world's your oyster.
Okay.
For me, I have to build my foundation.
Okay.
And I'm blessed to be where I am. I have a little bit of income. COVID's been difficult.
Right.
I have a little income where I'm beginning to do some online teaching.
Okay.
I did a TEFL course.
Okay, cool.
So I'm doing some online teaching.
All right.
Sort of my bread and butter. But I work on my foundation at the moment because it's so important.
Your recovery foundation.
Foundation, yeah, yes, my recovery foundation. And for me, that is...
First things first.
Steps 1, 2, and 3, right, initially.
Okay.
And I built a solid foundation for those. And to get
and you're
my...
working
change
on
my
patterns fourth step now. Behaviors. You're working on your fourth step.
And one of the joys of recovery is now that I have a choice. When I woke up in the morning, there was no choice.
Right, you lost the power of choice at that point.
The only choice was, how do I get more of something to change the way that I am?
Okay.
And now I have acceptance of myself, acceptance of the world, acceptance of others.
Okay, that's a big deal.
To move forward.
That's a big
deal. It's amazing. I can do things.
And that you never thought were possible for you.
I didn't believe I'd be sitting here. And to be honest, when you asked me to do this podcast, my initial response was going to be no.
Right. I remember we talked about that.
Yeah, there was fear around that.
Uh-huh. And now how do you feel? Pretty good, right?
Yeah, pretty good. I'm enjoying it. One beautiful thing is that I get to address my fears.
Yeah. So you're open about it. Well, thank you very, very much for all your time and your insights. I know we're going to hang out together a little bit. I will see you at some of these meetings. I'll see you on Zoom. And once again, Adam, our good friend, and great insights on his journey, which has been really inspiring. And I think the thing that I can observe is that, indeed, this was the gift of desperation for Adam. And all the hard work that he has done to recover and to move forward in his life and to share his story, his experience, strength, and hope with others. So this is Bruno J. signing off, and I'll see you next week. Tune in next week for the next episode of Busting Addiction and Its Myths, where we now have our weekly episodes titled by topic for you to search and download at your leisure, all in the interest of busting some myths and bringing you the truth about the face of addiction and alcoholism today.